All rise. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near. The court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. We are here this morning for the argument in the case of United States v. McIntosh. Are both sides prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, I've not heard of anybody reserving some time for rebuttal.
5 minutes, Your Honor.
5 minutes. If you're ready, please proceed.
Chief Judge Roy, Senior Judge Orr, Judge Mark Steiner, good morning, and may it please the court. I am Major Zalvin Saroyan, and I, along with Major Dan Shaney, represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Wilbur McIntosh. This court has granted oral argument on issues 1 and 5, and without preference from the court, we'll simply take them in order. Your Honors, the error in issue 1 can be distilled down to a single premise. The members in this case were allowed to consider, as substantive evidence, a finding of appellant's guilt made by a civil court that utilized a lower standard of proof than is constitutionally required in a criminal trial. When the military judge admitted this evidence through testimony, she violated the appellant's due process rights and at least 7 military rules of evidence, including MREs 401, 403, 608, 609, 701, 702, and 704.
Is it permissible to ever violate those rules of evidence if responding to a door that's been opened by the defense?
It would be permissible in certain circumstances if the door has been opened, but those circumstances are strictly prescribed, and it would require a limiting instruction, which in this case, though a limiting instruction was given by the military judge, the limiting instruction given only spoke to one of those MREs, which was 404B. It didn't speak to the other violations, and in fact, the way that the limiting instruction was given, the members were still allowed to use the evidence as substantive evidence of appellant's guilt. So, for example, the members could say, okay, well, we're not going to consider this evidence for the fact that, you know, Sergeant McIntosh is a bad guy. We're not going to convict him on that basis. But what we are going to do is we're going to consider this evidence as, one, going to the credibility of the witness, in this case Ms. Driver, and tangentially BH, which is also not allowed. But we're also going to consider this evidence as another witness. In other words, somebody, somewhere, somehow, found that these crimes had been committed. And so we get to use that evidence as well, completely ignoring that he was a bad guy, but still consistent with the military judge's instructions.
Where is the request for an instruction by the defense counsel in this case on that matter?
The defense objected when the instructions were proposed, and they essentially indicated that they were going to be insufficient. And realistically in this case, there really is no instruction that could be given. And here's why, Your Honor. So, in this particular case, the members heard, and the argument is they either heard allegations that there was sexual abuse, that's the government's position, or they heard essentially implicitly a court ruling that was determined that there was sexual abuse. The members were blind as to what weight to give that evidence. Specifically, even if this court finds the government's argument that only allegations came forward persuasive, the members didn't know what allegations came forward. A review of 120 shows just how broadly the term sexual assault or sexual abuse can be viewed. I mean, was this a butt slap? Or was this vaginal penetration? The members had no idea what the allegations were. They just heard of sexual abuse.
Well, let me ask you this. Would it have been to the defense's advantage for the judge to spell all those out?
I think that that steps aside of the issue. In this particular case,
so
it's the members.
Is the issue? Sir? That is the issue.
In this particular case, the issue is that the members have to be the ones who determine the credibility of the witnesses.
Correct.
In this case, evidence came forward which was used to speak directly to the credibility of both BH and Ms. Driver as to whether or not they were specifically telling the truth. That's not allowed under MRA 608. But even if an instruction were given trying to correct that, the problem that they faced, that the members faced, is that they didn't know the allegations. More importantly, they didn't know who made the allegations. So they couldn't judge the credibility of the people making the allegations. In other words, they were totally blind as to what weight to give this evidence. And if they don't know what weight to give this evidence, they don't know its probative value. And it will then fail MRE 403.
You had mentioned earlier you couldn't conceive of a situation, correct me if I'm mischaracterizing, you couldn't conceive of a situation where a curative instruction would have worked in this particular context, is that correct?
No, Your Honor, we could not conceive of a situation where a curative instruction would work.
Are you familiar with the curative instruction the military judge gave in Bauman?
I am not, Your Honor.
Okay, I'll wait and ask that later on down the road then, or maybe the other counsel.
Well, and going back for just a moment, the reason that we believe that a curative instruction would not have worked is because, regardless of whatever instruction was given, right, let's assume the instruction was perfect in every way, to the extent one could be created. The members still couldn't have possibly known what to do with that evidence, because they couldn't determine, essentially, what the evidence was. They didn't know the allegations. They didn't know who was making the allegations. They didn't know the credibility of the people making the allegations. They didn't know the timing of those allegations. They had no way to understand how to give that evidence weight.
Now, the government was perfectly happy to provide that to you. Counsel objected.
Because it violated... This is something of a catch-22.
Correct.
In other words, this evidence violated a whole host of military rules of evidence.
Well, why were they even talking about this at all?
That's a fine question.
From voir dire, from opening argument, from cross-examination, defense counsel kept reiterating that the mother was lying.
Yes, Your Honor. That was the defense theory, is that the mother had made up these allegations. I guess perhaps I'm not understanding Your Honor's question. That was, in fact, the defense theory. The defense theory is not prejudicial to the appellant.
Correct. But opening the door, maybe.
I guess...
The bottom line is nothing... If defense counsel had never used this as a reason for lying by the mother, none of this is relevant, correct?
Your Honor, with respect, none of this is relevant anyway. In other words, we're at a loss to understand how the mother lying is relevant to bring in a state finding.
Well, that wasn't what was brought in, was the state finding. The trial defense counsel in this case was portraying the mother as having either a motive to lie to keep the children, or a motive to lie in order to continue getting the money from the appellant, although those two things seem to be at odds with one another, but those were the two theories espoused by the appellant's counsel in this case. So they've laid out this idea that the mother is a liar. Why isn't the government allowed to come in and provide rebuttal testimony to show that, in fact, she's not lying about this?
The government is... I apologize, Your Honor.
That seems to be what they were trying to do in this case, was to bring in this testimony to say that, look, she's not lying about it. The kids have already been taken, or the child in this case has already been taken from her by the state. But she's not a liar. She's not making this up for her own personal bias or reason to gain something. But that was a theory brought out by the defense. Case law allows the government to rebut that, even through the use of what would otherwise be inadmissible testimony or evidence. So why isn't that this case?
I'll take those in order, Your Honor. So the prosecution can rebut that, and there are as prescribed by the military rules of evidence, ways that they can rebut that evidence. So, as an example, mom was on the stand. Bring that out in redirect. People know mom. Put people who can talk to her credibility, to their opinion, as for her reputation, as to truthfulness, through MRE 608. There are a myriad of ways that the government could have rehabilitated this witness. But just because there's this myriad of ways they can do it does not create a wholesale application of bringing in any evidence they want. Now, the government has cited Bresnahan for this theory that otherwise inadmissible evidence can be brought in once the defense opens the door. There's a couple of things to consider. Bresnahan is also very clear that says, but that doesn't mean we get to sort of eject MRE 403. We still have to go through that balancing test. Bresnahan was also limited specifically to profile evidence. It did not expand itself beyond that. And so while the government is trying to articulate an expansion, Bresnahan does not stand for that. And so in this particular case, the military judge didn't jettison MRE 403 and in fact found for the appellant. I would direct this court's attention to the record at 802, where she says, quote, I find the probative value is outweighed, substantially outweighed, by the danger of unfair prejudice, confusion of the issues, or misleading the members. She goes on to say, to the extent there is unfair prejudice, I will give a limiting instruction. But again, her limiting instruction only spoke to MRE 404B. It didn't speak to any of the other violations. And more importantly, as this court held in Hughes, to allow a person to speak to the credibility of someone who's not even at trial is atomic bomb, and that's a quote from Hughes, an atomic bomb-like prejudice. In this particular case, it wasn't a person who was speaking to the credibility, it was the state. And when the members heard that BH had been removed from her home against her will and her mother's will, these allegations, if that's all they were, appeared conclusive to the members.
Then how was he acquitted of the sodomy charges?
Well, I think that goes to the weakness of the government's case. In other words, first...
Well, you're going both ways now. You want to say that this was so powerful that no jury could disregard that, and yet that seems to be exactly what they did. They looked at the facts and the evidence presented and didn't rely strictly on the findings of the state, which, of course, the findings were never made. They just said that they were removed because of allegations of abuse. I think that's the only thing that came up, if I'm not mistaken. And so there were no findings discussed, no adjudicatory decisions made, told to the members. It was simply these people were the kids were taken out because of allegations of abuse. So I guess I'm just wondering what evidence the members, I mean, what you're seeming to imply is that the members were so overcome by the weight of the state's findings here that they couldn't give it their own decision on what to do with the evidence or what findings to make, and yet with the allegations of sodomy, that's exactly what they did.
And that's a fair question, Your Honor. I'll take this in parts. So it's interesting to note that if this court takes Ms. Driver's testimony, Ms. and BH's testimony, sets them aside, and looks at just the allegations that came forward, you get the same result that you have here. Now, as to the sodomy wasn't alleged. It was just sexual abuse. Common understanding of that is, generally speaking, vaginal abuse, maybe oral sodomy. But there was nothing that was discussed specifically about anal sodomy. And so you could set BH's testimony aside, you could set Ms. Driver's testimony aside, and the allegations alone would be enough for the members. Interestingly, it appears what may have happened is the members refused to consider anything that was essentially uncorroborated. And how we know that is BH specifically spoke to being anally sodomized. It was direct testimony. It was clear. clear. It was unwavering. It was an incident in a computer room. She was home late. She didn't make it to school, so she was home in the morning. Appellant came in, essentially threw her on the bed, put her underwear and her sweatpants down, and then anally sodomized her. The senior trial counsel, did it go in your vagina? No. Only in my butt. Her words. And so the members completely set that aside. And so the question is, are they essentially using this state finding to corroborate and plug holes where they can? Because it appears that the government conceded that Ms. Driver got, their words, hammered on cross-examination, so she was severely discredited, and BH's testimony is being looked at askance as well, which goes to show the power that this essentially third testifier, the state, is having on the proceedings.
But that's, again, not what was said at trial. What was said by the social worker was failed to protect from an allegation of sexual abuse with no other further clarification. Didn't talk about the type of sexual abuse, whether it was vaginal, sodomy, or any other way. So it sounds like the members made a determination based on credibility of the witnesses and strength of the evidence alone to parse out what they found guilty and what they acquitted on. So I'm having a little trouble figuring out that one line where it just talks about sexual abuse, where if that was so powerful, as I put it, if that was so, that overcame the ability of the members to judge the evidence, how that happened with the sodomy charge, and why he was acquitted of the sodomy charge and not convicted of everything. I mean, it would seem to be that it would, to me, that it would be applicable to all of the allegations of sexual abuse. Right?
So if I understand Your Honor's question.
It wasn't a clear question I got. I'm trying to think this through, but a very, very short comment. Can you please tell the members what CD allegedly failed to protect BH from allegations of sexual abuse? And I think that was the end of the conversation. Sexual abuse would seem to include both the rape and the sodomy, and yet they acquitted on the sodomy. So how is it that this evidence is so powerful that the members couldn't disregard it, and yet that's exactly what they seem to have done?
So if I understand Your Honor's question correctly, we're asking, what's the prejudice?
Okay.
And there's some disagreement between the appellant and the government as to what the standard of prejudice is. It is appellant's contention that this is beyond a reasonable doubt. There was an implicit substitution of the burden of proof. The government's own case in the United States v. Walker, which is 57 MJ 174 at 178, seems to support this understanding that it is a constitutional error. However, regardless of which error and which standard this court utilizes, we should first be clear that it's the government's burden. That's also in Walker. That's also at 178. So whether it is beyond harmless and beyond a reasonable doubt, or it is that there was a substantial influence on the findings, it's the government's burden to show that didn't happen.
Of course, the judge instructed the members accordingly along those lines, correct? And she gave the standard instruction, the government always has the burden of proving each of the elements.
She does, but she also allowed this evidence in for its substantive use. In other words, the members were free to use this. Just by way of example, the members were free to use this evidence, this judgment on the credibility of the testimony of Mom and BH in violation of MRA 608 as substantive evidence of the believability of Mom and BH. And this court could look to United States v. Cameron, United States v. Wagner, and United States v. Tomlinson, which was an Army case cited with approval by Cameron, as evidence that the CMA and indeed this court is not going to allow someone, in those cases, someone to opine on the credibility of the testimony or the guilt or innocence of the accused, which is exactly what happened here. So,
counsel, aren't there fairly well-developed lines of cases dealing with credibility and or human lie detector type information, the admissibility of profile evidence? Even commenting on an accused's right to remain silent, if such evidence is offered in rebuttal or in response to a door opened by defense. Because it's not, and I just want to make sure I understand the source of your consternation or the way you're articulating it correctly. Is the crux of the error you're describing that, is it a product of the fact that the judge did not sufficiently narrowly define a tailoring instruction regarding the extent to which the members could consider this information? Or is it the admissibility of that information in toto? Several times you've refuted the number of military rules of evidence violated by the fact that this evidence was admitted. It's my understanding there are fairly well-accepted circumstances in which information that would otherwise be inadmissible under the MREs absolutely can come in response to an open door. So I know it's a really long question. Let me rephrase. Is the crux of your concern that the tailoring instruction was not sufficiently narrow, or that this evidence was permitted to come in at all because there are no circumstances under which it could come in?
Both.
So it is the latter. It's your contention there's no circumstances whatsoever under which this could have come in, irrespective of how narrowly the judge tailored an instruction regarding the extent to which it could be considered.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that goes back to one of my initial points, which was the members had no information on this allegation. So assuming for the moment that it was admissible, Your Honor, and this is going back to Senior Judge Rohr, your question, assuming for the moment this was admissible, and assuming for the moment that the judge admitted it, well, then she's got to admit it all, right? So the members have to be able to weigh, to know what evidence, actually to know what weight to give this evidence. So they were sort of allowed to walk the fence. They couldn't go to one side or the other. So they weren't given enough information to judge the credibility, and it wasn't kept out in its entirety. So in trying to walk this fence, there was error on both sides. Now, it's appellant's contention this evidence should have never come in. The prejudicial effect is the judge found, and there's no evidence of an abuse of discretion. As the military judge found, the probative value of this evidence was substantially outweighed by the prejudicial effect, and that brings us back to United States v. Hughes. Despite that, she didn't limit the instruction. Now, we don't think she could have because the members didn't have the information to weigh the credibility of this evidence. They didn't know who made the allegations. And this kind of goes to MRE 401. Did Mom make these allegations? There's no evidence that Mom made these allegations. None. Now, there is, I'll retract that. That's a bit of an overstatement. Ms. Frey indicated that Mom didn't make these allegations. Through cross-examination, she changed her position and she said, I think she did make these allegations. But that evidence is belied if you take a look at Mom's testimony, right? Mom was surprised that her daughter was pulled out of her house. Not likely to be surprised your daughter's pulled out of your house if you're the one making the complaint to CPS. So taking a look at the record in total, Mom didn't make these allegations. We don't know who made these allegations because nobody testified who made these allegations. So because the members didn't have what they needed to weigh this evidence, there's no instruction that could have corrected this error. Assuming for even a moment that there was an instruction that could have corrected this error, the one that was given didn't speak to all of the problems, in particular the MRE 608 problem, which essentially says that we're not going to allow you to use this evidence to determine the credibility of the witness. Now, if we go back to MRE 401, and I've heard a couple of questions, Your Honors, from, well, defense opened the door. They challenged the credibility of Ms. Driver. Well, they did. The problem, however, is that there's no evidence that these allegations supported anything she said. We don't know that she made any allegations. So whatever door might have been opened, this wasn't the proper vehicle or the proper evidence to prop up her testimony.
So just to be clear, you're saying defense did open the door?
We're not conceding that she was challenged. We're conceding that her motive for bias was brought up.
Okay.
And so to the extent that a motive for bias was brought up, there were proper means to address that, indeed, whether it be on cross-examination, be it through proper evidence under MRE 608, but as done, this was entirely improper. I see that I have approximately 1 minute left, and so if I might just briefly move to Issue 5.
Well, I do have a question real quick.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just real quick, you said in your, I believe you said it's constitutional error to admit Ms. Fry's testimony because it effectively admitted the juvenile court's decision as a substitute. I think that's, do you have any case sites where that is from anywhere, military or civilian, to back that up with respect to it being a constitutional error? Because obviously the judge never said anything, that the burden ever shifted from the defense, excuse me, from the government to the defense, or that discussing a civilian adjudicatory decision somehow is a constitutional error. I'm just looking for any case law that you may be able to cite along those lines.
We don't have any case site, Your Honor. Essentially, if you take a look at how this evidence came in, the evidence that came in, they were discussing custody. It's commonly understood that custody is determined by state courts. If this court looks at the record, I believe it's at 611, Ms. Frey is asked, did Ms. Driver lose custody? Answer, yes. And so it's common knowledge that custody matters are determined by state court, and so not only would it have been a reasonable inference by the members in this case, but in fact it was the correct inference.
Can I ask you, who raised the issue of custody in the trial at all?
I believe it initially came up in voir dire. I'd have to look back then, but I'm pretty sure it was the defense that brought it, actually the government that brought it up in findings initially.
The government brought it up first?
I will have to double check, Your Honor, but I believe the government did bring it up first in findings. I can get a cite on that for you.
Because I think you, the issue was raised in, let's see.
If I may, Your Honor, I know it's an opening. It's hard to imagine that in today's environment that someone could be so twisted to use this type of an accusation to try and keep custody and money. But I believe that's exactly what the evidence is going to show you. I think that's defense counsel's opening.
Okay. I'll take Your Honor's word for that. I'll certainly double check it. But at opening statement, even if we're discussing the issue of custody, that is the issue of gaining custody through the normal, and I guess we've got two simultaneous tracks going on here, right? So we have the standard divorce track, and then we have the track of what the state is doing. And so those are two distinct and different issues, and what the defense was arguing was through the normal course of divorce, which Ms. Driver had signed off on, they were discussing that. As an example, Your Honor, so the initial SANE report, the initial SANE examination in 2007, that was done in May 2007, which is the same month that Ms. Driver received the divorce papers. And so they're talking about custody as through divorce, as opposed to custody as through the CPS and the state pulling BH out of the home.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, we'll give you that extra minute you were looking for, because we cut you off, if you want to take a minute or so to discuss Issue 5.
Issue 5 has been fairly well briefed by appellant. In short, the defense had in its possession not one, but two SANE nurse examinations. These examinations, the original one, as I previously mentioned, was in 2007. The second one was in 2010. These examinations bookended what was apparently and allegedly 3 years of violent rapes. And yet, despite these alleged violent rapes over the course of 3 years of a 10-year-old by a full-grown male, there was no evidence of injury whatsoever. In fact, even the young girl's hymen was still completely intact. The defense had this evidence, and yet they did not introduce this evidence. Now, the defense counsel has indicated that would have prevented them from making their main argument, which was, government, where's the evidence? Except that ignores the fact that even if they introduced these same examinations, they could have still made the very same argument, except they could have held up two documents that said, where is the evidence? And they failed to do it. In short, Your Honors, what they failed to do was introduce the only independent evidence made by two separate nurses, 3 years apart, who had no dog in the fight, that supported the defense's position.
But then the ultimate comeback from, I guess, from the defense counsel's affidavit was he was certain that the two same nurses would say also that it doesn't mean that it didn't occur either, that there in fact could have been the rapes going on, you just wouldn't have had the hymen affected, right?
Watch that, Your Honor.
And that would have also opened up the door to apparently the DNA test for the semen residue on the girl's underwear, which had not come in from the government. At least it potentially could have. Wasn't that a rationale they were using not to go down that road?
So the DNA evidence, well, let's back up a little bit. If you take a look at civilian defense counsel's affidavit, he says, I'm certain the same nurses would have said X. That's great. But you've got the civilian defense counsel who, by his own admission, has 30 years of experience, is extremely qualified by his own assertions. And yet, he doesn't say whether he even interviewed them. It might well be the case that the nurse from 2007 would say, yeah, if this is the only test, it doesn't rule it out. I've seen it 10 times, 100 times. But did he interview the nurse to say, what if you've got two that are 3 years apart and you've got repeated rapes? Is that at least evidence that it might not have occurred? But we don't know that. And oddly, he doesn't include that he interviewed the nurse examiners at all. He then says, well, I interviewed my expert. And my expert said, oh, that doesn't rule it out. Again, what he didn't include is, did you ask your expert whether these two exams, which bookended these violent rapes, one of which, the first one in 2007, took place mere hours after the rape, does that shed some light on the issue? But he doesn't discuss that. And interestingly, it's almost as if he attempts to put this off on both his expert and on the appellant. This court need look no further than United States v. Witt to realize you're not putting this off on the expert. You have an independent duty, regardless of what that expert says, to take a look at the legal evidence.
Isn't the standard in IAC, though, not merely the raising of a reasonable question about additional investigation that could have been done, but rather the demonstration of what that investigation would have disclosed raises a more than mere conceivability, but I'll mistake the term, a substantial probability of a different outcome in the case. So it sounds to me like what you're saying is, hey, he didn't ask these couple of questions, the repetitive nature of the assaults that went on for such a long period of time and how that would have impacted. My understanding of the IAC jurisprudence says, in order for you to prevail, you've got to go one step further and say, and if he did ask those questions, here's exactly what he would have discovered, and here's how that would have led to a reasonable probability and a different outcome in the case.
That is a correct articulation of the law, as I understand it, Your Honor. I think if, sort of jumping to the prejudice analysis, if we want to set aside that for the moment and simply put this in front of members, since they would have been the ones who would have made the determination. Essentially, we have two cases side by side, where in the one case, you're simply arguing, where's the evidence? And in the other case, you're showing members who are not lawyers, listen, members, we've got two same nurse examinations. These nurses, I don't got a dog in this fight. They don't care if appellant's guilty or not guilty. Both of them came back with the same results. There's no evidence of rape. Now, maybe one, as the government articulates, doesn't resolve the issue. But we don't have just one. We have two. After 3 years of raping a 10-year-old girl by a full-grown man, that evidence before members in a case where it appears certainly at least the members aren't entirely buying BH's story, and certainly where the government is concerned with mom's credibility, there's a very likely chance that this would have changed the result.
Is there any evidence anywhere in the record that that suggests civilian defense counsel's asserted rationale? That is, hey, look, it's not uncommon for sane nurses to say this doesn't really prove anything. Is there any evidence anywhere in the record that contradicts that or casts doubt on that? You know, that calls into question his articulated tactical rationale for choosing the course he did?
I think, Your Honor, it would be a reasonable inference. In other words, both documents state negative findings don't.
It's a different issue. Whether you and I might agree that that's a reasonable inference right here is different than whether or not there's any information that sort of supports our assumption in that regard. So I'll concede that even if you and I agreed that it was a reasonable inference, have I missed anything in the record that sort of supports that conclusion?
Not in the record, Your Honor. It would simply be common sense in ways of the world.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any further questions?
No further questions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Thomas Alford, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Taylor Smith, represent the United States in this case. The military judge below properly admitted the testimony of the social worker, Ms. Genevieve Fry, and in doing so, never missed the civil and criminal burdens of proof. Furthermore, civilian defense counsel was absolutely not constitutionally deficient when he made the tactical and very likely smart decision not to admit the same reports. Along with the other 18 assignments of error, this court should deny appellant relief. With regard to the burden of proof issue, first, nowhere in Mrs. Fry's testimony was there a mention of a finding of any court, civil or criminal, nor did Ms. Fry ever testify that there was a final determination made in any proceeding.
Didn't you leave that impression, though?
Well, Your Honor, she said that...
I know what she said. I'm asking if there was the impression left when you say that the child was taken out of the house because of allegations of abuse. I mean, that's a state action taking place. So there was certainly some finding somewhere, may not have been by a judge, but somebody within the Child Protective Services or the judge, I guess in this particular case, whoever signs off, made the decision to remove that child. Now, you talk about common sense playing out to the members. Somebody said take that kid away, and there had to be some evidence, and you pointed to the appellant as the reason that child was taken. I mean, that's pretty much the only inference you can gain from what happened in this case.
Well, Your Honor, factually, you're correct. I mean, you can make that inference, and appellant is asking you to do that you go down this logical chain and make that inference, but she never testified about any kind of burden of proof, and that's really what's important here. And the ultimate thing that she says is allegations of sexual abuse. Well, what did the members think he was at trial for? Allegations of sexual abuse. So they're even looking at the testimony, they could reasonably conclude that, yes, there are allegations of sexual abuse, therefore the BH had to be taken from the home. That doesn't mean that the issue was solved. Obviously, they were there to make that decision. The members were there, and that was never in question. In fact, we can tell that because they never had a question about that particular line of testimony. After they got that answer, after the three out of the nine members said, allegations of what, or why was she removed from the home? And then the judge came back and said, I've redone that 403 balancing test. I'm going to allow that question because I don't want them to speculate. And they came back and the question was allowed. Then at that point, they had no questions. And they had no questions in the after findings instructions, nothing about that. I'd like to correct a factual error that the appellant stated, and that was during Ms. Fry's testimony. After after she said allegations of sexual abuse, civilian defense counsel then got up and questioned her further. It said, allegations of sexual abuse, correct? Yes. And the allegations were made in part by Ms. Driver, correct? No, they were made by other family members. Oh, so you have no knowledge of Ms. Driver making an accusation also. Is that your testimony under oath? I believe that she did. So she made sure, once civilian defense counsel again opened the door, to state where the allegations came from. So appellant stated that the members had no idea where it came from. They certainly did, because civilian defense counsel came in and invited that error. Now, defense counsel, that goes back to defense counsel opening the door. He opened the door both by his opening statement and by all of his cross-examinations. And the third point I'd like to make is that to not allow the government to go down this line of questioning would hamstring the government to answer the main question. And Ms. Driver's testimony was especially relevant to this case. It was especially important to the government's case. And for the government not to be able to come back and say, with an independent witness, and say no, that she didn't have a motive to fabricate, because she was so close to the appellant that she actually stayed there despite knowing that her daughter had been raped before. I mean, that is crucial evidence that the government had to put on. After the defense counsel didn't just open the door, he kicked it down in his opening statement. And I would ask that this court look at the record. In his opening statement, the defense counsel mentions custody 13 times. He says, we're going to hear about Tidy. Tidy Driver actually has physical custody of BH right now because the state has apparently taken BH away from her mom. So it's hard to imagine that in today's environment that somebody could be so twisted to use this type of an accusation to try to keep custody and money. But I believe that's exactly what the evidence is going to show, and that's at page 288. He goes on. The evidence will show that Kathy lost custody of the kids, that Sergeant McIntosh's family now is the kids. So call it what you want. That's where that's where things are at this particular point. That's at page 289. Now again, you've got to understand the dynamics here. I mean, you would think that if this woman really, really found her daughter being sexually abused by this man, she wouldn't let him go anywhere near. She wouldn't let him get anywhere near her again. The last thing in the world she would do is let him back in the house. That's at page 289. So the defense theory that she was fabricating all of this to get custody or to get him out of the home, for them to just throw that out there, and trial counsel made a great point when she said, defense counsel can't just go around planting weeds in our garden and then not allowing us to pluck them out. And the military judge recognized that. And that's what her...
What was the whole purpose of this statement from Ms. Fry? Wasn't it not to show that she didn't voluntarily give up custody of her daughter?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
And if she said 13 times that she has, what are you rebutting?
Well, their theory is that she fabricated this to get custody and money, and because he was going to get custody pursuant to the divorce, that she, you know, wanted to make up these allegations somehow in 2007. It was a strange theory, because even after the divorce, the appellant moved back in with her. So the government had to be able to come back and say, no, she's not making this up, because she's actually, in a way, complicit in all of this. She's allowing him to come back into the home, and the state had to come in and take her away. So it's a strange logic, but that's exactly what the trial counsel was articulating with the judge.
So why not just ask her, do you have the child anymore? No, I don't. Why do you need to bring the state into this to give what appears this, the power of the state, having made a decision under whatever standard they make, best interest of the child or preponderance, whatever they used, to give the state's weight in this case? That seems to be the problem. Once you start implicating the state taking action, I think the appellant's argument is you've given credibility to the idea that he's already guilty. Why not just ask her?
Well, Your Honor, I would direct this court's attention to the cross-examination of this driver, and it was a several-hour cross-examination stretching from pages 481 to 547, then a recross, an additional 10 pages on 561 to 571. He was impeaching her. He was trying to undermine her credibility. So in order to rehabilitate her, it required an independent witness. You couldn't just go back and ask that particular witness because she was the one that was being attacked. Now, they came back and they tried to put in Prosecution Exhibit 9, and this is an important point here for the court, that the trial counsel thought, well, at this point, he's definitely opened the door, so we're going to try and put in Prosecution Exhibit 9 for identification. But when you're looking at whether the military judge abused her discretion, it's important to recognize that she did exercise her discretion, and she said no. That's actually a bridge too far. Prosecution Exhibit 9 contains the words in there by a preponderance of the evidence, and there's hearsay problems, there's an affidavit attached to it. So she excluded that, and that's when you see her doing the 403 balancing test, she's saying that the probative value of that is maybe fixed, but the prejudicial value is way higher because of that burden of proof mentioned in it.
What's the functional difference? She allowed the statement from the state worker to come in and repeat what the judge or whomever had made the finding. I mean, where's the functional difference here? Whether you put a piece of paper in saying the state took the kid away, or the social worker saying the state took the kid away. She still allowed that evidence to come in before the members that she had originally said was too prejudicial. So what changed?
Well, Your Honor, in the adjudicatory order, Prosecution Exhibit 9 for identification, it contained the words beyond a preponderance of the evidence, I think, or words to that effect. When the social worker came in and testified, Ms. Fry came in and testified, she never talked about that burden. She actually didn't repeat much of what it was. She said she was removed from the home because Ms. Driver failed to protect her from allegations of sexual abuse. It wasn't, we found that there was sexual abuse. Nothing like that. In fact, she didn't even say who it was until civilian defense counsel came back in like a bull in a china shop and said, yes, no, it's because of these allegations. It's because of, he actually went and he listed who made the allegations. So, it's...
How are the members...
So, I mean, in substance, I do think it's different. And she does conduct the 403 balancing test three different times. She does it on page 802, 810, and 823. And the government would propose that she does the balancing test properly. It appears that she misspeaks when she says that the probative value is substantially outweighed. Because she let the evidence in, the government's contention is that she was saying that the probative value outweighs the danger of unfair prejudice, and then she went on to say, to the extent that there is any undue prejudice, I'm going to give a limiting instruction. That's another thing this court has to consider, is that she gave a limiting instruction two different times, once right after the testimony, and then again in findings.
What's your opinion about the adequacy of that limiting instruction? I mean, I understand what you're saying on the first point about the term allegations, the child was removed based on allegations, blah, blah, blah. I think the way that it's, one could argue at least, the way that that's translated to the minds of the average jurors is somebody said there was bad stuff going on sexually with the kids, the state subsequently came in and took them. Somebody, you know, they wouldn't do that unless they were, you know, they had shown up those allegations. So subject to that argument, maybe to contrary interpretations, what's your opinion about the adequacy of the curative instruction? I'm curious also if you're familiar with United States versus Bauman, it's a 2000 CAF case.
Well, if I could answer the first question regarding the limiting instruction, Your Honor, on page 832, I think this is right, when she gave the instruction, she said, yes, members, you are not to conclude from Ms. Fry's testimony that the accused is a bad person or has criminal tendencies and that he, therefore, committed any offense charged. Do you understand? Affirmative response from all members. No questions. Based on the fact they didn't have any questions, it appears that the members understood that. Now, whether it could have been crafted differently, I don't know. I can't jump into the judge's mind, and I don't want to Monday morning quarterback the judge, because it's possible that if she had started getting into burdens of proof, if she said, you know, this was a preponderance of the evidence standard, and you can't, that would actually confuse the members more. And as you pointed out, Your Honor, she did give that instruction, the reasonable doubt instruction, in the beginning and then at the end of the trial. So they knew what the standard was. So that wasn't a question. So the government would propose that limiting instruction was proper. Did you say United States versus Bauman?
Bauman, yeah.
I believe in that case, if I'm recalling the case correctly, there was an error, but the error was found to be harmless because in that case the military judge was using 25-year-old incidents. That's not the case here. Here we're dealing with the exact same allegations that he's on trial for. So it's not as if you need to look at, is there this prejudicial impact of some other misconduct?
But what I find interesting is in that case, and let's just assume here we swap out words allegation of sexual assault for or sexual abuse for divorce or items related to divorce. The judge's instruction in that case, and you're exactly right, it was information about whether or not the appellant had sexually abused his younger sisters 25 years earlier was allowed to come in to sort of rebut what had been characterized as an open door. And in crafting the limiting instruction, the military judge said, members of the court, concerning Ms. Baum's response, I have allowed that question for two purposes, and you may consider it for these limited purposes only. I allowed it to show her motive for finalizing this divorce. Here you might swap that for making, you know, allegations. And that's the limited purpose. I also allowed it for, and it may be considered by you, for the limited purpose of its tendency, if any, to rebut the contention that the defense, that there is some ulterior motive by Ms. Baumann in filing for this divorce or in making these allegations in that case. And for its limited tendency, if any, to rebut the defense position that she is not a credible witness because of that, or that she has some ulterior motives for testifying the way she testified in court, or that her children had some ulterior motives for testifying the way they did in court. You may not consider this for any other purpose. And then the instruction there concludes with the same sort of boilerplate, and I don't intend that as pejoratively it sounds, but the stamp. Oh, it's not a bad guy, no criminal tendency, blah, blah, blah. And in this case, despite the sort of narrow tailoring of that instruction and focusing on the limited tendencies for which the members could consider it, it was still found to be error. So your characterization, I guess I'm having trouble wrapping my arms around your characterization that if the court found that not to be, if the court found error in that instance, why is it not error in this instance where the instruction was much, much more cursory, much more general, you know, much more sort of attenuated?
Yes, sir. I think that case is more having to do with the actual evidence that came in itself, not necessarily instruction, and kind of went to your question to appellant, like, what is it, the evidence or is it the instruction that you're having an issue with? And it appears that he conceded that defense counsel opened the door. But to your question, Your Honor, in that particular case, they were dealing with allegations that had nothing to do with what he was on trial for. They were old, so the probative value was very thin, so all the more important for the limiting instruction to be exact. Here you have a very high probative value because they're trying to rehabilitate this bias. It wasn't so much that the allegations of sexual abuse were what was key here, it was that BH had been removed from the home against her mom's wishes. So whether the limiting instruction could have been better in articulating that may or may not be the case, but the question is, did the military judge abuse her discretion? The military judge did not. She went through the 403 balancing test several times. She crafted the limiting instruction. She said it twice. She said the reasonable doubt instruction again. So we would say that Baumann is a completely different case. And in Hughes, again, you're dealing with evidence that had a very low probative value, and then this, what the court said, atomic bomb of prejudice. In this case, the appellant's defense counsels who dropped the atomic bomb, he wasn't going for precision-guided bombs in his opening statement to try and avoid opening the door. Like I said, he kicked it down.
You believe there was prejudice by the comment that the state had made a decision to remove the child? Just in and of itself, that piece of the question we're looking at, do you believe there was prejudice from that statement?
I think any evidence that's put in against an accused can be prejudicial, Your Honor. But the question is the probative value substantially outweighed? And I don't think that it was. And the military judge went through that calculation.
Well, did she? I mean, you look at it, twice she said this was so prejudicial that we're going to keep it out. And then for reasons that I can't divine on the record, she says I kind of reconsidered and now I'm going to let it in. What changed? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, I think, and I don't mean to belabor the point, but going back to Prosecution 9, which is what she kept kind of referring to, because the trial counsel wanted to get that back in, and she wouldn't allow it because of the affidavit. It was mostly, it appeared to be the hearsay problem, and then the prejudicial impact of the burden of proof being specifically mentioned. So that's what it seems like she's viewing this evidence in toto, and then she's looking at, okay, how do we limit this specifically? And when I limit this testimony to these very specific questions, at that point, it's no longer a 403 issue, and it's admissible. And I just want to point out, too, that appellant is coming here now and saying that this wasn't admissible under 608, it wasn't admissible under 704. That was never objected to. So in a prejudice analysis, that's plain error if you're looking at, if this is an ultimate question issue, that's a plain error analysis. And I don't think, and then the burden falls on them to prove that, I don't think that they have. So if this is just a 403 question, though, the military judge is afforded a great deal of deference.
Are you fairly limited to only look, I mean, they objected multiple times at trial to this evidence coming in, whether it was through documentary evidence or through the social worker testifying. I mean, the same basis for the evidence was being objected to, right? Whether it was under 403, whether it was under 404, whether it was 608, 702, I mean, there was an objection to that evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
So don't you think that preserves the issue on our review?
I think it preserves the issue for 403. I think it preserves it for relevance. And then when we look at a prejudice analysis, we're looking at non-constitutional error. And appellant has done as good a job he can in trying to say that this is a constitutional error. And in fact, he filed a supplementary assignment of error alleging a confrontation clause issue, saying that no, this was actually it was a Crawford issue because she was testifying about something that she didn't know. So that would raise the prejudice bar to a constitutional bar, but it's not. It's a non-constitutional error. So this court ought to look at it under that lens if you do find an error, in which case then you can say, did this have a substantial impact on the findings? It did not. This was a collateral matter. They were trying to rehabilitate this witness. If you look at all the other evidence, you have BH testified about years of sexual abuse. You have the mother, Kathy Driver, testified about an incident that she witnessed. You have her friend, an aunt witness, walked in and saw something going on. You have DNA evidence and soiled panties. And then you have appellant's own admissions to Ms. Driver when she confronts him about this, when she comes in and the door is locked and he's putting his pants up and she confronts him and he says, I have a problem, I'm sick.
That goes to the strength of your case, not whether it's a collateral matter, because the state took the kids away for allegations of sexual abuse. The guy's on trial for sexual abuse of different types. I'm not sure I agree with your looking at this as a collateral matter. It seems to be straight on point. And then you're giving the weight, again, I call it the weight of the state's determination, and we're trying to, at least I'm trying to figure out how much that would have played on the members' minds when the limiting instruction simply is under a normal 404B, you can't say he's a bad guy, but where's the instruction that says you may not make your determination on what the state did in this case at all? That's what seems to be missing. I think that's what appellant's counsel is arguing. Where is that instruction? How do the members know to disregard what the state may or may not have done in this case? Because that's not here. And there, it does seem to be fairly prejudicial when you bring the state's determination into this matrix.
Yes, Your Honor. And, you know, the record is what it is, and the limiting instruction is what it is. But the purpose, and that's the key here, is, as you know, Your Honor, in evidence, we always look at what's the purpose of putting in this evidence. And the purpose trial counsel offered this evidence was a collateral matter. It was to rehabilitate that particular witness. And then the military judge actually took it a step further and said, I'm going to give this limiting instruction saying, you can't consider this to assume he's guilty of the offenses. That alone goes right to the heart of what the appellant is saying. State court or not, burden of proof or not, she said, you can't consider it for this purpose. Whether the members follow that or not, we'll never know, but that's what we have, and that's the purpose of instruction. And in the court assumes that the members did correctly follow that instruction. So, you know, I don't mean to dismiss it, that it could have a prejudicial impact. It certainly could, but it would certainly be more prejudicial if the military judge had led in Prosecution 9, which had the actual burden of proof in there.
That's the test, a substantial finding, a substantial impact, like you testified, even if it's a non-constitutional error. If that's what we do. So I'm just trying to go along that line. It seems to have a pretty possibility of a substantial impact on the findings when you bring the state in there, and there's no limiting instruction that says you have to disregard what the state did with respect to making your determinations on guilt or innocence of this accused. I got it, you're rehabbing the individual, but why the state is a player in this
That's the question I've got in my mind.
I would just go to, Your Honor, that it was never actually specifically articulated that it was the standard of proof. The members never had a question about the instructions. They knew what the reasonable doubt standard was. So, I mean, like I said, the testimony is what it is. We can't change that. And what the prejudicial impact could be, the military judge hit the nail right on the head. She said, to what extent there is a prejudicial impact, I'm going to give this instruction. She may not have said specifically, the state, you can't consider the state, but in doing that, she may have highlighted as well and confused the issue even more.
Yeah, but what about this? It's, defense counsel argued, or said during his opening statement, you're going to hear from two people that... the mother doesn't have actual physical custody of her daughter right now because the state has apparently taken the daughter away from the mom. If defense counsel says that in the opening statement, why is any of this necessary? Why is the rebuttal part necessary if he's already said it to the state?
Well, I think even more so, that's invited error or opening the door, that he dropped that atomic bomb. And so the government, when he then impeaches a government witness, the government then ought to be able to come back. If he volunteered that information to begin with, they should be able to come back with an objective source and say, yeah, actually, that is true, to remind them that Ms. Driver did not have a motive to fabricate, Your Honor. And if I could jump to the ineffective assistance of counsel issue. Thank you, Your Honor. Appellant's allegations clearly failed to meet the first prong of the Strickland test, which require that appellant demonstrate that his counsel's performance was so deficient that they were not functioning as counsel within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment. That's the high bar. Also, in keeping with Strickland's standard of deference to defense counsel, the former Court of Military Appeals held that it would not second-guess strategic or tactical decisions, and that's from United States against Morgan, 37 MJ 407. Now, looking at the three-part test from United States versus Polk, first question is, are the allegations made by the appellant true? Yes, they're true. They did not admit the same reports. The prosecution didn't admit them. The defense didn't admit them. But the question, the inquiry goes further. Is there a reasonable explanation for counsel's actions in the defense of the case? Absolutely, yes. Mr. McCormick and the trial defense counsel, the military defense counsel, made a strategic call, tactical call, not to admit the same reports. And for this court then to second guess them and establish a per se rule that says, no, anytime you have this type of evidence, medical evidence, you are bound, you are ineffective if you don't put it in, would create an absurd result. Now, I would point this court to the Civilian Defense Counsel's closing, which takes place from between pages 917 and 954. And the Civilian Defense Counsel plays this card up, the lack of medical evidence. He says, where's the medical evidence in this case? This child was violently raped, sodomized by this man. He put his penis in her butt. He put his penis into her vagina on multiple occasions. We have one incident that happened apparently hours before she was examined. Government, where is your medical evidence? When a child has been brutally raped and sodomized, she goes in for an examination. There's no examination. There's not one single piece of medical evidence in this case. There's nothing to support this contention. There's nothing to support that this man put his penis into her vagina or butt. Nothing.
So why not bring up the fact that two independent sane nurses say exactly what he just said? There's nothing there. They looked at it. You would think over years of sexual abuse of the type alleged, you would have... the hymen would have been impacted. It wasn't. So, I mean, it seems a little odd that you wouldn't put up a pretty powerful piece of evidence to support the very theory that you just read off of his argument.
Well, Your Honor, they took the wind out of the prosecution's sails, because if they didn't do that, the prosecution put that evidence on, that's true. They could say it's exculpatory. But then the prosecution can just come back with their expert and say, well, actually, no, that doesn't indicate that she wasn't raped. It just means, you know, X, Y, and Z. That there can be instances of rape where there's no injury. And so the government was not able to do that, so it was actually a windfall for the defense when the government didn't put that evidence in, because then the defense, and Mr. McCormick talks about this, he made a tactical call with appellant's consultation that we're not going to put this evidence in. And now appellant is saying, he was ineffective for making that tactical call when he was acquitted of sodomy, two specifications of sodomy. And who knows, maybe they considered that there was no medical evidence, so we're not going to go that far, but there was enough evidence with the vaginal rapes that we are. So to second-guess this decision when the appellant actually benefited from his civilian defense counsel hammering that point repeatedly in closing argument would lead to an absurd result. And even if this were of ineffective assistance of counsel, then you have to look at, if he put that evidence in, would there have been any change? Well, maybe he would have been convicted of the sodomy then. We don't know. But we know that if that evidence had come in, then the government could have rebutted it and said, well, that doesn't mean anything. There can still be no injury, and there could have still been a rape. So there would be no impact whatsoever, even if you find ineffective assistance of counsel. And so the government would say, would ask this court not to establish a per se rule establishing ineffective assistance of counsel. And if I may briefly conclude. Thank you, Your Honor. Because the military judge below properly admitted the testimony of the social worker, Mrs. Fry, and in doing so, never mixed the civil and criminal burdens of proof, and because the civilian defense counsel absolutely was not constitutionally deficient when he made the tactical decision not to admit the same reports, this court should deny appellant relief. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chief Judge Rome, you asked, what is the functional difference of Ms. Frey's testimony and Prosecution Exhibit 9 for identification? None. There was no functional difference. And when those members heard about the allegations, those allegations were conclusive because BH was removed from her home by the state who has police, who has a police authority to remove her. It was very clear that the state had acted on those allegations, and they believed them to be conclusive. Now, the government indicates that the defense opened the door. Assuming for the moment that that is true, and I would note the defense talked about it in voir dire. They talked about custody in its various forms in voir dire and an opening. The first mention of custody, however, was on in findings, is at 356, 357. That's a spontaneous statement by BH. It was not in response to a question. But even if the defense opened the door, one, that does not jettison MRE 403. And they certainly did not open the door enough to drop an atomic bomb through it. But that's exactly what happened. There were proper ways to do it. And one of the ways to do it is to bring forward relevant evidence. Now, the government up here could not even articulate how this was relevant. They used words like, I know it's strange logic, and it's a strange theory. If it's strange, it's not relevant. If we can't figure it out, neither can the members. Now, the government also stated that what was important was BH had been removed from the home against her will, against her mother's will. It wasn't so much the allegations. Well, then that means the allegations weren't relevant, and they shouldn't have been admitted. The government also contends that the military judge must have misspoken when she was doing the MRE 403 balancing test, except if she did, she misspoke three times. She misspoke at the record at 802, 810, and 823. That's a lot of mistakes, if in fact it's a mistake. Did this have a substantial effect? It is interesting to note that every single person at trial thought this evidence would have a substantial impact on the findings. Clearly the defense did. But the government, through its actions, conceded that this would have a substantial impact on the findings. You had a very experienced senior trial counsel who tried to get this evidence in various forms, be it through Prosecution Exhibit 9, through identification, or through testimony, and kept going back to the well time and again. Even when the military judge, speaking as to Prosecution Exhibit 9 for identification, said, it's not happening, trial counsel. She was forceful. Even when senior trial counsel said, well, we can remove all of the information about, you know, the state finding and all of that, not happening. despite that, senior trial counsel kept going back to the well. It seems somewhat incredible to articulate that a senior trial counsel who keeps doing that, who keeps trying to get this evidence before the court over and over in different forms, wouldn't think it was going to have a substantial influence on the findings. So the defense agreed, the government agreed, and then the military judge comes forward and says, probative value in this case of this evidence is substantially outweighed by the prejudicial effect. And it's hard to imagine a scenario where a military judge is going to make that finding if she didn't believe it was going to have a substantial effect on the findings. So everybody who was there, everybody who saw BH, everybody who saw Ms. Driver, everybody who saw the members agreed that this testimony, this evidence, was going to have a substantial influence on the findings. Now, Judge Roan, going to your question with regard to the DNA, you indicated, wasn't it a reasonable decision to keep this evidence out because they didn't want the DNA to come in? The DNA came in. If I would direct this court's attention to 725, to the record at 725, and specifically also to 734. The DNA evidence in this case had already come in. The horse was out of the barn.
Was that machine residue, or was that just...
I was discussing the DNA evidence, and I believe there was also some indication as to the match, that it couldn't rule him out. So the DNA evidence that they had, Your Honor, came in. So any discussion as to not bringing the same nurse exams to avoid this discussion is without merit, because it had already come in. Now, the government... I see that I'm out of time. If I might just have one more moment.
Go ahead.
The government indicates that civilian defense counsel made his decisions with consultation by appellant. Appellant conceded to this course of action. Well, a review of his declaration, appellant's declaration, would indicate that's not correct. But even assuming it was, this court is well aware that it is the sole province of counsel to determine strategy and tactics with consultation, but they do not get to jettison their responsibilities simply because they have a conversation with the appellant. Barring any further questions?
All
right. Your Honors, the members in this case were allowed to consider as substantive evidence the actual holding of another court that utilized a lower standard of proof. This violated appellant's right to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt by competent evidence and tacitly substituted the burden of proof from beyond a reasonable doubt to a preponderance of the evidence. This evidence was critical in convicting appellant in an otherwise weak government case. It is also in light of a weak case that appellant received ineffective assistance of counsel when they failed to submit same nurse examinations taken separately and together. The errors contained in issues 1 and 5 doomed appellant chances to a fair and reliable trial. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank counsel for both sides for very informative and well-argued presentations this morning. We will take this case under advisement, and we will render a decision in due course. There being no further business before the court, we're adjourned.